I've never seen The Goonies, which I know is heresy for a millennial, I guess.
Right.
But I've never seen it.
A geriatric millennial, Jamie. You're a geriatric millennial.
I don't need
you. You got to eat your mushy peas and Jello while you're killing fucking TGI Fridays and Applebee's.
Listen, man, my knees remind me loudly of my geriatric status. Every time I walk upstairs, there's like a...
I heard it.
It's bad.
It was bad.
Super bad. I don't have any cartilage left. Anyway, welcome everyone to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I am the movie guy. Rest in peace, Richard Donner, recently deceased, director of The Goonies, and also good movies.
Also good
Rip
movies.
Rip Dick Donner.
We're pairing wine with movies and hopefully dissecting the synesthesia between the two in a way that doesn't want to make you bash your head on a wall. Today we started with a wine pick, which I described to Scott, and he chose a movie.
That is correct.
So today's wine is Chateau Vieja, a chateau in Maduran. This is their tradition bottling. Maduran is an area famous for growing Tannat, but it also grows Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and the much unknown and maligned Fair Servidoux. The words that I gave Scott for this wine are big, dark, powerful, refined, and constructed. And there's going to be a probably major mea culpa on my part for this wine once we get to it, but those are the words that I gave Scott to base the pairing on. Scotty, what movie are we pairing with this wine?
Well, based on big, dark, powerful, refined, and constructed, I chose yet another of my favorite movies from 2020, the year that wasn't. This concludes our, I guess, retrospective on 2020, a year that ended roughly yesterday and also 16 years ago. And we're watching She Dies Tomorrow. This is a movie written and directed by Amy Simons. It is currently available on the Hulu, so if you haven't watched it yet, I highly recommend it. And as Jamie and I will frequently advocate for, it is an 85-minute movie, and all hail the sub-100-minute movie. But I think it is big. I think the emotions are big, but also the direction is, there's some big swings in the direction. There's a lot of ambition in the way she tells the story. The subject matter is extremely dark, and the movie mostly takes place at night and is like deep, inky black shadows. I think the craft is very powerful. Like it elicits strong responses, and she has refined her craft down to something very specific. And the movie is kind of constructed. I might have whiffed constructed a little bit. There's like a narrative flashback thing that is a construction. And also there's like this elliptical kind of storytelling that I feel is constructed as well. It's, I don't know.
Yeah, but those things are maybe a little secondary in
right,
this
to the
movie.
Other to,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we might as well just get into the wine.
Yeah.
We'll do wine first this time.
Well, you picked wine. We start with wine. So let's go with wine.
Yeah.
Tell me about wine.
All right. So the big mea culpa here is Chateau Vieja is a producer that I have been familiar with for years. However, when I placed the initial orders for these wines and I got really excited when I saw Chateau Vieja, you know, fall into the price point target for the podcast, I not even didn't think about the fact that this producer makes more than one wine.
Jamie, that seems like a huge oversight for a wine professional.
Yeah.
Are there any producers who only make one wine?
There are. There are not many of them.
Right.
Most of them make it like minimum two.
Okay. So there's no salvaging this for you. You just thought, oh, I like that name. Therefore, this must be the wine.
I got excited. All right.
Okay. All right. That's fair.
I'm excitable sometimes.
That's fair.
The wine that I described as big, powerful, dark, refined, and constructed is their Prestige bottling, which is their top end, and it is 100% Tannat. That wine is built specifically to age. Tannat is, its claim to fame is that it's known as the most tannic grape varietal. And I know that there are wine nerds out there who are really mad that I said the word varietal instead of variety. And to all of y'all, I say, fuck you.
For anyone at home playing with there, you're going to need a bigger bottle bingo card. Ooh, that's kind of hard to say. You're going to need a bigger bottle bingo card. You're going to need a bingo bottle bigger card.
We're going to need to print off some you're going to need a bigger bottle bingo cards.
Yeah, for our
fans. I got that on the first try.
Shut up. Anyway, if you're playing at home, not only has Jamie already made up some vocab words, but once again, Jamie is taking a defensive stance against the straw man of other wine nerds out there who will be mad at him for something that he said. So that's on your bingo card.
There's an annoying debate going on about the use of the words variety and varietal, and I just couldn't give a shit, and the people who want to die on that hill make me annoyed.
Can you summarize this interestingly and in 30 seconds or less?
No.
Okay.
It's not interesting, which is why I'm mad about it.
Okay. All right. That's fair. I was hoping it was interesting. It's not interesting.
It's not at all interesting. If it was interesting, it doesn't matter. Okay. So.
Not interesting.
Tannat is famously the most tannic variety or varietal.
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 We say varietal on this show, Jamie.
That's right. That's correct.
Yeah.
The prestige bottling is exactly as I described.
Okay.
It's huge. It's full-bodied. It gets a long maceration on the skins, which extracts extra tannin and color. Hence my use of the term constructed. It's a wine that is built. You crush the grapes, you allow it to macerate prior to fermentation, which is called a cold soak, and then you continue the maceration through alcoholic fermentation, which then extracts compounds that are alcohol soluble as opposed to the ones that were water soluble, which you pulled out with the cold soak.
Okay.
That's the constructed part of it.
Right. And the prestige bottling is the expensive one?
Correct. It's like $50 a bottle.
That's a lot.
So this wine
right.
is the tradition bottling.
This is not our first tradition.
No.
I thought tradition was like the name of a different wine that we did before, but tradition is a style of bottling.
No, it's the name. Like this is not like a legally protected word or anything. It's sort of.
Is it like a classification strata? Like prestige is expensive and tradition is.
I mean, think about what those words communicate to you.
Sure.
You know, if you see the same producer on a shelf and one says tradition, the other says prestige, and you see this price differential, you're going to kind of understand what you're getting into. The tradition being the one that is easier to drink, and the prestige being the possibly more age-worthy, but also much more refined and expensive or whatever. Tradition is just is a term that a number of wineries that I've encountered have used for their entry-level wine.
Okay. So it is a common term for an entry-level wine.
And for those of you who haven't listened to all the episodes, the previous tradition wine was the Barmes Boucher Riesling tradition. The difference here. First big difference is the varietal makeup. 60% Tannat, 40% Cabernet Franc. Cabernet Franc is a much less intensely structured high tannin variety. It brings with it some herbal vegetal notes as well as some floral notes, a little bit of a higher acidity and a lighter body. Basically, the addition of the Cab Franc to this wine allows it to be a little bit less brooding, a little bit less dark, a little bit brighter, and certainly not requiring of extended aging the way the prestige bottling is. I would still consider this to be constructed. I can tell that there was a fair bit of winemaking going on here. There was a cold soak, as I described before. There was a longer maceration, but not as long as the prestige. There is oak here for sure. They were going for a style.
Would you age this? Because the other one requires aging. Would you,
I would say
you sell her this for?
No longer than 10 years. But I think this is 2017 vintage, and I think it's kind of right in the pocket. It tastes really good.
All right, so you talked about being able to detect if something is too young before. If this wasn't right in the pocket, if this needed to be aged more, how would that manifest? What is a too young version of this wine taste like?
This is a really great question.
I thought so.
And it's a question that I've asked myself a lot, and I have consistently failed to answer it.
God damn it.
It's hard, man. It's ineffable.
Well, then how do you know that it's in the pocket?
Because I've tasted a lot of wine. I can sense it without words. I've struggled to put words to it, is what I'm saying. This is a question that I have asked myself, and I continue to struggle to put words to it.
Okay.
The most that I can give you is that based upon the grape that I'm tasting and the place that I'm tasting from, I have an expectation of what aromas I'm going to get. And if some of them are muted or I can't detect them at all, then I can tell that a wine needs more age. Also, either I can smell specifically hydrogen sulfide, which is sort of like a rotten eggs, kind of like stinging the nostril thing.
Great.
That's a very young wine that has just been bottled with either too much or a little bit of sulfur and just really needs time. The too old question is easier to answer. A wine that has gone too long smells like stanky ass mushrooms.
Okay.
You ever have a, this has happened to me and it's a very specific sense memory, but have you ever gotten mushrooms from a grocery store.
And you put it in the fridge and you leave it too long, and then you pull the box out of the vegetable drawer and it's turned liquefied.
That's
like
right.
It did to me this morning.
Oh, wow.
And then when I cleaned the drawer out, I accidentally spilled disgusting bad mushroom juice in my sandal.
Oh, wow.
Which may have to be thrown out now. So yes, Jamie, hypothetically, that has happened to me.
When I was a baby, Sam, I used to tolerate that because I thought that's how old wine was supposed to taste.
Right. But it was just wrong.
But it's just too old. It's past its prime. It's oxidized. It's bad.
Okay.
Throw it the fuck out.
All right. Fair enough. I think you've kind of answered the question.
I kind of answered it. And I will continue to ask that question whenever it comes up. It's the constant interrogation that'll get me there, hopefully.
You got it.
So anyway.
This wine's in the pocket.
I think this wine is in the pocket. It doesn't feel like there's much more to be unwound. You know, the fruit is in a good place. You know, we've got the blackberries and the blueberries. They're fresh and ripe. It's not very earthy. There's a little bit of an oak tone. It feels like it's expressing itself. And I know that this is all entirely subjective because I'm using the language of like someone who's tasted, I don't even know what the estimate on how many wines I've tasted in my life is at this point, but it's certainly in the 5 digits.
Yeah. Really? That's a lot.
I mean, consider that.
Right. You go to a tasting and you have like
500.
In a single tasting?
Yes.
In a day?
Yes.
You'll sample 500 wines?
Yes.
Do you get anything out of that experience? There are diminishing returns.
Yeah. And if you don't strategize your day properly, you basically get nothing other than drunk. My first one, I was just me trying to get through it all and really not getting anything. And that really taught me to strategize. Like, make sure that you schedule breaks for yourself and be conscious of the wine styles you're tasting. Because if you're going from table to table and you like have a light fruity, you know, Pinot Gris from Willamette Valley and then go directly into Barolo that just has like clawing, raking acidity and tannin, and then try to taste Albarino after that, mm-hmm. you're going to get nothing.
That's kind of akin to attending film festivals. You try and sit in a dark room and watch 5 movies a day every day for like a weekend or a week or 14 days. Like, I couldn't do that anymore. Like, back when I briefly went to festivals before I just like worked them. Yeah, it was like I'd have to bring a little notebook. And I think I can max out at 3 a day. Otherwise, I just forget all of it. It's just all gone.
And it just sort of melds together. Yeah, and
there's no chance for retention. And I'm not even drinking while I'm doing that.
Right. And I admit it, like, I'll be spitting while I'm at these tastings.
Right.
But there are mucous membranes in my mouth that alcohol can be absorbed through. So, Chateau Vieille.
Yeah. Can I give you my thoughts? I have them. They're written down. So, again, referring to my little notes, helpfully organized in my Wine Folly Tasting Journal. And you tell me where I'm erring here, Jamie. So, in the intensity of the color, I declared it to be deep.
Yep, I would concur.
Hue somewhere between purple and ruby. It is deep and dark.
Yeah, I would be firmly on the purple camp.
All right, I was second guessing myself. I edged towards ruby. All right, fine. The smell, wife takes. My wife was getting almond. I wanted to include that because I left out all of her extremely thoughtful wife takes last time because we had so much arguing to do about Tennant and Sherry.
We had so many things to say.
So many things to say. I wasn't getting a ton that I could identify on the nose. This is again, part of the thing. Maybe I feel like I'm having more success discerning specifics in the whites than in the reds.
This is an interesting phenomenon that I experienced in my come up in wine. And I'm happy to see that you're having a similar experience.
Yeah.
And it's a thing that I've heard from a lot of other people, which is that prior to getting into wine, you know, in an intellectual or professional way, people tend to prefer reds, just generally speaking. And that's true of you. Over our friendship, you've generally drunk red with me more often than white. However, once you get into it, it is a little bit easier to discern things about white wine. They're a little bit separate from one another.
Right.
Red wine feels more integrated with itself, perhaps.
That's a way to put it. Yeah. All right. So it's the wine's fault. It's not my fault that I can't discern specifics.
No. This is a thing that I have been conscious of for years.
All right.
That people entering this space tend to want to gravitate towards reds, but then ultimately end up gravitating towards whites because it's easier to wrap your head around.
Yeah. You feel like you're getting more out of it.
Yeah. And you're like, tannins often stand in the way of like tasting things. Like that like raking texture can obscure flavor.
Hmm. Well, here's what I did get. And I did the work. I had several glasses. You and I had...
We had a bottle together in your theater.
We watched the movie. Yep. And then I had a good chunk of a bottle last night and continued to work at it. But so on the nose, I was getting red bell pepper question mark. I'm not super confident about that, but there was some kind of sweetness that I couldn't describe. And I had a flash of red bell pepper, so I went with it. Cherries. Don't ask me what kind of cherries. They're just cherries.
What kind of cherries, Scott?
Cherries, Jamie.
Currently in my refrigerator at home, I have sour cherries and I have Rainier cherries.
And there's Bing cherries and there's maraschino cherries. And then there's the kind of maraschino cherries that I get, which you turn your nose up at because that red, delicious, sweet, sugary syrup is terrible.
Is
but I love
carcinogen.
Them anyway. Oh, wait, really?
Yes.
Like one of the bad ones?
I mean, you'll probably be okay.
All right, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
That's not going to be the thing that kills me.
No. Right. No, it's all the other things.
Right. And then let's see, on Madeline's little chart here for your taste, I was saying medium plus on body. I feel like I can intuitively say if something is high or low body, but I can't necessarily describe it. What body is, it's not texture. Is it thickness?
It's think
like
of it
viscosity?
As viscosity.
Okay.
The most useful way that I've been able to describe it and get other people to understand it is think about milk. Skim, 2%, full, heavy cream.
Okay.
That makes sense to you?
That scans.
So skim is light body.
Yeah. Heavy cream is
full body.
Full body. Yeah. Okay, fine. Well, this is like a half and half. I put down medium plus. It felt...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Good. Medium on the tannins, like they're there, but they're not knocking me out?
I would go medium plus, and medium maybe plus. That's my bias because I know that there's tannat, but my only argument here is... I think we're very used to feeling high tannin wines in our gums and in our cheeks.
In our teeth.
This one, feel the way it rakes on your tongue specifically, which for me is an indication that the tannin is specifically from the grape and not also from the oak.
The oak gives tannin too?
Yeah, oak is tannic. And you can feel them in different parts of your mouth.
Well, I don't know where I felt it, but I felt a medium amount of tannin. The alcohol, I have no barometer for alcohol in red wine, it turns out. So the bottle says it's like 13.5%, I think.
No, it says it's 14.3%.
Shut up. Whatever. And then I guess it's kind of sweet. It's also a little dry. There's like some sweetness to it.
I don't detect really any measurable sweetness here.
It's super dry?
If we put this through a lab, my guess would be... somewhere between 4 and 6 grams per liter. Nothing to speak of.
That's not a lot.
No.
Okay. How many grams are in a liter? You can't measure that because grams are weight and liters are volume.
No, you can't because a milligram of water weighs the same as a milliliter of water. There is a proportionality.
There's a crossover.
Yeah,
I don't need you to explain.
Because metric is smart and American is dumb.
I believe we call it standard in this country, James.
Actually, I think a lot of us call it imperial, which is a problem.
Well, at least it's honest. my remarks on the taste are, it tastes like red wine. I got a flash of like something savory. And maybe it's because my brain wanted to pair this with red meat, but I was getting something in the ballpark of like a medium rare filet. I don't know. I can see it when I was drinking it. And then my other thought, and you're going to like this. I think I'm correct. Jamie, is this wine non-linear?
Non-linear.
Because a linear wine is something that tastes the same in all parts of your mouth, in the front of your mouth and the back of your mouth, right? That's how you described linear to me before.
I described it to you as like a movement of the wine directly down the middle of your tongue. A directional kind of sensation. I would say that this wine does not have that. I would agree with you.
Okay, well... Based on what I thought you described linear as before, or linearity, I was getting different notes in the front of my mouth than I was in the back of my mouth.
Interesting. So what were you getting up front?
Up front was where the sweetness and the savory were. What fruit notes and sweet notes I was getting were up front. And in the back of the mouth, I was getting a little bit of spice. Don't ask me what kind of spice. I don't know. Just like some kind of heat spice and bitterness. But I wasn't getting that in the front. But like if I held the wine up front, I would get different notes than when I held it in the back and then swallowed it.
I think you
is that,
what else you got? Anything?
That is it. Oh, also, it tastes like red wine.
good one. Yeah. I think you did a fabulous job. And that red pepper thing, that is specifically a characteristic of Cabernet Franc.
Ah, see, the student has become the...
The something.
The better student.
The student has moved to the head of the class.
Right. The student is in the first grade now. Nap time is being phased out. We will still have milk cartons for snack before lunch. Man.
I miss having naps and snacks.
Naps are nice.
I say that, but now that I'm like self-employed, I take naps.
Right. Well, because you also get drunk in the middle of the day.
That is not true, okay? No, I think you did a great job describing this wine. It's, I think, mostly black fruit, blackberries, black cherries. I think that that red pepper thing is definitely there. I don't get much of a, as you said, like savory filet mignon thing on this wine. There's maybe something.
Is there salinity? I can't.
I don't think it's salty. Maybe something sanguine. Maybe a little irony.
Yeah, I mean, now that you say it, because I'm suggestible. Yeah, now I can discern.
Yeah, it's not specifically beef, but there's something a little bit metallic about it. The only thing that I really disagree with you on is that I think there's a little bit more tannin here than you said. Other than that, well done.
This is also the first red wine I've ever like charted my medium minus plus minus minus plus.
I'm proud of
takes
you.
On these things.
Very, very proud of you.
Indubitably.
Yeah. So this wine is made by fourth generation winemakers. The estate was acquired by the Bordolucci family in 1952. And you may be thinking to yourself, Bordolucci does not sound like a French family.
No, it does not.
They are not. They're Italian.
Kind of gathered.
But they moved to France. You know, the previous generation had been grape growers, or they had actually been sharecroppers in Friuli. So they had previously been in viticulture. This was their first family-owned vineyard. So currently, there's the two daughters of the third generation are running the estate. And they're about our age. Scott doesn't like it when people our age are more successful than we are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm resigning myself to it.
Yeah.
Especially when people like much younger than us are very successful and like creatively very ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know, I recently learned this, Bo Burnham is 7 years old. It's crazy. I thought he was like young. I had no idea he was seven.
He's actually
wunderkind.
He has just reached the age of reason.
He doesn't even have pubes yet. And he did a song about sexting. Anyway, I digress. So the third generation, they are roughly our age.
They're roughly our age.
Okay, great.
And obviously very talented winemakers. The family bought the property in a state of pretty massive disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
The chateau was constructed by the Marquis of Vieja in the 18th century and was basically ruins up until 2003 when it started to get repaired. They now run an agrotourism, which is essentially a bed and breakfast on the vineyard in addition to making the wines. Seems like a really nice place to go. I would very much like to go to there. The southwest of France is kind of an interesting story. Vines were brought here like many places, most places in Europe by the Romans during conquest. It was part of what was called Aquitaine back then, which included Bordeaux. But as history progressed, the wines from southwest of France and Bordeaux were, you know, prestigious and respected sort of the known world over. Then Bordeaux got super powerful and enacted a bunch of policies and tariffs that basically relegated wines of the Southwest, including Mâturon, to local wine status. They were not exported widely, and Bordeaux sort of took over the fame of the region because they were wealthy and they could do that.
Wow.
It's kind of an interesting situation.
Interesting is a word for it. It's pretty fucked up. It's extremely messed up.
It's super fucked up.
It's par for the course.
Yeah, it's bad. None of it's good. It's all bad.
Don't approve.
And there's, you know, a lot more to say about all of that. One of the big things to come out of Mâturon is the technique of microoxygenation, which is introducing small amounts of oxygen to a wine in order to soften it, which means to polymerize tannins, which would make your sensation of them less aggressive, generally, and not needing so much age.
How do they introduce the oxygen? Because I only just learned when we were talking about sherry and the fucking Solera system that you so exquisitely and concisely explained last time.
We should pause for a moment for a much more succinct description of the Solera system provided by Friend of the Pod.
Friend of the Pod Pre, yeah.
Friend of the Pod Pre.
A succinct movie reference explanation or analog for the Solera system that I am ashamed of myself for not coming up with.
Yeah, Scott should be ashamed, and also I should be ashamed, because this is both kind of accurate and entirely hilarious.
Very funny.
The Solera system is the human centipede of wine.
Yeah.
And we're going to leave you to sit with that.
Yeah. And if you didn't listen to our previous roughly 102-minute discussion of both Tenet and Sherry, go do that and give us some listens and you'll understand this joke, and it's very funny. The human centipede of Winecraft.
That's correct.
That's right.
Introducing oxygen, it can be done in a number of different ways.
Yeah.
Basically, you put a tube...
Into the barrel?
Into the barrel and connect it to a tank of oxygen and add a little bit at a time.
Huh.
Yeah, it's relatively simple for a big word, but it's a thing that allows a lot of Mataran to be drunk earlier, to be more accepted on the international market, and it's been used widely in a lot of other places as well.
Hmm.
And that's what I got on this wine.
Jamie, let's play the game.
Let's play the game.
We're going to Wine Folly. WineFolly.com. Jamie Rubin versus Wine Folly. I will solicit from Jamie what he thinks the top five principal flavor notes in Tanat, even though this is a blend.
Yeah, but it's best to do it that way.
Well, we haven't talked about Tanat before, and
right.
I was pretty sure until I got to Wine Folly that Jamie made that up. Because I really only thought there were like five grapes before. And now apparently there's like this crazy number and you just keep
there
making up more, and then
thousands.
The internet verifies you.
There are 3,000 indigenous to Italy alone.
Do they all become wine?
Yeah.
Wow. That feels like too many.
It's a lot.
That doesn't seem like we need that many types. You need your Chardonnay, your Pinot Gris, your Champagne.
Oh, man. He's trying to start
Cabernet. He's
trying to start a fight right
need
now.
Need a little bit of rosé and ginger ale. That's it. That's all we need.
Okay, guys. So when we're done, don't expect any further episodes because I will have killed Scott with my hands.
Okay, so Jamie, James Rubin, what do you think the five principal flavors of Tanat are, according to the esteemed editors of WineFolly.com?
My name's not James.
I said Jamie, quotation marks, James, unquotation mark, Ruben.
Fuck you. Five flavors for Tanat. We've got blackberry, cassis.
How do I spell cassis?
C-A-S-S-I-S.
Great. What is cassis?
Cassis is dried currants.
Dried currants. Okay.
Black currants, specifically.
Okay.
Not red currants.
Dried black currants. Great.
Potting soil.
All right, potting soil rears its ugly head again.
Sage, and let's just go with black cherry, because I think I'm getting a lot of fruit on this particular wine, and we're just going to take it in a more fruit-driven direction.
Even though this wine is only 60% Tanat.
That's correct.
Okay, great. So Jamie says blackberry, cassis, or dried black currants, potting soil, sage, and black cherry. Drum roll, please. According to Wine Folly, the top five principal flavor notes in Tanat are... Holy shit, black currant. Put your hand down. You're not. Nope. No, your moment of glory is over. Plum, licorice, cardamom, and smoke.
I'll give him smoke. I disagree with cardamom. Also, when you say cardamom, you have to be specific. Is it green cardamom or black cardamom? Because those are very different things.
Are they? I've only had black cardamom then.
Green cardamom is super, like, high-toned, almost citrusy, like coriander, but amplify all of the, like, the orange zest notes to it. And black cardamom has some of that sort of high-tonedness to it, but it's got this base, like, smoky, savory flavor.
Mm. Smoke is maybe what I was talking about, my, like, savory, meaty, maybe salty note, like, maybe...
Yeah,
maybe my brain was crossing a wire and it's not steak, but it's, like, steak on a grill, like red meat on a hot grill.
Yeah.
Smoke makes sense.
Plum makes sense. It's just not a note that I use very often.
Yeah. I don't know that I'm getting any licorice off this, though.
I'm definitely not getting any licorice off this, but also there's a ton of... There's 40% Cab Franc here.
Hmm. Well, I like it.
Yeah, I like this wine. I'm enjoying drinking it.
Yeah.
This is the type of wine that I don't often drink because I tend towards lighter-bodied, kind of acid-driven reds when I drink red. But I'm always kind of happy to have it in my glass. It's comforting. It gives you a little hug.
I don't know if it's a hug. It is warm.
It's not warm, sharp. I would call it round, and it's like texture.
I was thinking about the shape of it last night, that there is a roundness to it. Also a purpleness to it. And not in the color, but the taste. I kept thinking of purple magic marker.
Talking about synesthesia here.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
It's a little purple.
It tastes a little purple.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you what kind of cherries there are in it or in the world.
Black cherries.
But purple.
Yeah. I like the wine. I think it's good.
I like it
too. Not exactly what I intended for this movie, but I like it a lot.
Yeah, it we're getting into the crossover a little early, but like I picked this movie because this is like big, aggressive movie in terms of like its content and its style. Like
it is.
It doesn't care if you can't keep up, and it just like
it just keeps on trucking.
It just keeps on going.
And to be honest, there would have, I think, definitely been synesthetic things to say
in the Prestige
with the Prestige
worldwide.
But I think it would have amplified all the unpleasantness of the film.
Mm.
I think it would have, in the same way that for me, the Fabrice Gasnier, the acidity and bubbles amplified the tension and anxiety.
In Parasite. Yeah.
The Prestige, the tannin structure, constructed nature of it would have amplified the existential dread that this movie gives you.
Yeah, I mean, it, like I said to you after we watched it, that the only like synesthetic crossover that I had at all was that just the wine was stable. It felt stable and comfortable and familiar to me.
It's like a nice walking stick to go along the journey with this movie. Anyway, we're going.
We're all over. Let's talk about the movie.
Yeah.
So she dies tomorrow, which in terms of like plot is pretty simple.
Not a lot of plot.
A young woman named Amy, who is, we're meant to believe, is like a recovering alcoholic, becomes convinced through circumstances that are later revealed, but not so much revealed, that she will die tomorrow. She has this unwavering belief that she is going to die the next day. And we basically watch her over the course of 85 minutes, like grapple with this, but also every single person that she encounters, starting with her best friend, Jane.
Who is not a good friend.
She tries. Jane's trying. Mm. Jane's got her own problems, man. Jane's got her own problems.
She's there for like 5 minutes and she's like, I will not be held hostage.
Well, but Amy, she was back on her shit, man. She was back on her shit. Anyway, every person that Amy encounters, her friend Jane, a guy that she rents a fucking dune buggy from, everyone that she encounters, she infects with the idea. She tells them, I'm going to die tomorrow. And they all tell her it's crazy. And then 10 or 20 minutes later, they also become convinced that they will die tomorrow. And it spreads and spreads. And Jane spreads it to her brother and her sister-in-law at a dinner party. And it keeps spreading. And the movie is very, it's not interested in whether this is a real contagion or pathology. We never know if it's a real thing or not. We never actually know if any of them die from believing they're going to die. The body count is only
one
the entire movie. That's not what it's about. It's
about how people grapple with the knowledge that they're going to die.
Right.
Whether or not it is true.
Right.
You know, you are certain you're going to die. How do you behave?
Right. So it's written and directed by Amy Simons, and she has spoken about in numerous interviews for the movie that she is obsessed with her own mortality. It's a thing that infects
her. Making her, by the way, the only human ever to be obsessed with her own mortality.
Don't diminish the woman's experience. I'm saying it's important to understanding this movie.
I'm not. It's a common theme. I'm obsessed with my own mortality.
I'm obsessed with your mortality, too. I'm just running down the clock here on you, pal.
That was fucking rude, especially since you also are obsessed with your own mortality.
That's a pretty recent development for me, guys. Oh, yeah. The last 18 months have not been great. Simons has talked a lot in press for the movie about how the movie is like super personal and not autobiographical for her. But like she said to a bunch of people, she said to Matt Zoller-Seitz for Vulture, who did a great profile and interview with her that we'll have to share a link to. But she said that death is the cruelest joke. You know, you're born, you're conscious. And the entire time, the trick is to deny the inevitable. The main character in the film is, in a script that she wrote, is named Amy. She thought that let's just throw the artifice out there. Like, there's no use in pretending that this isn't about me. She filmed it in her own house. Like, she self-financed it. She said that she wasn't comfortable in the house before shooting the movie. And now the film is so much about, like, feeling an atmosphere that now she feels like she has a relationship to the house. And now she likes living there. She's not, like, fucking haunted by it. It had its virtual premiere at South By, and then the distributor Neon released it, you know, to virtual cinemas and all of those weird experiments that we were all checking out last year. but I watched a couple of Q&As with her that she conducted, some of them from the home, which was the set of the movie.
That's
so like
bizarre.
You just watch the movie and then you switch over to the live stream of the Q&A over Zoom.
And
it's like, oh, she's just fucking there.
She's
like,
on set.
Yeah. But she said that that made her feel more comfortable with it. But yeah, it is so intensely personal and you can feel it. And it's so specific in the way that it's personal, right?
Yeah.
There's a great scene in the movie where character Amy, played by Caitlin Shale, her friend Jane, who comes over and tries to like coax Amy out of, she thinks she's just fallen off the wagon. Jane is played by Jane Addams, who is like a veteran of the Indian TV scene. And she rules.
She's
and
fabulous.
She's great in everything.
But Jane, the character of Jane is a piece of shit.
But she's not a piece of shit. She's mentally ill. She is straight up mentally ill. We are meant to infer
is
that
she?
From... Yes.
Did I... What did I miss?
So Jane, who is now infected with the idea that she is going to die tomorrow, goes over to her brother's house for her brother's wife's birthday party, where Jane is clearly not welcome. And Jane starts spouting off to all of them how she's going to die tomorrow. Through those conversations, we start to hear more and more from the brother played by Chris Messina and from the sister-in-law played by Kate Asselton about all these crazy things that Jane used to do. Oh, she was so crazy one time and we were going to travel and then she couldn't leave the hotel room. She clearly has some kind of anxiety. Like she,
yeah.
The woman struggles. So let's not just say that she sucks.
Well,
like,
I mean, here's my
she's
reason.
She's a bummer.
My reasoning
she's not a good party
for
guest.
Saying that she sucks. Because my first viewing, I thought that Susan, Chris Messina's wife,
right.
was just being shitty to his sister.
To Jane.
But then on reexamining her first interaction with Amy.
She could be more supportive.
She could be supportive at all. Admittedly, she showed up. That was something. But the person for whom you're the first call has told you that they are convinced that they are going to die tomorrow. Like if you, Scott.
Yeah.
Called me and said, I'm not okay. And I came over and you were wasted on the floor and you were convinced you were going to die tomorrow. I would stay with you and make sure that you were seen by a professional.
I mean, that's
true. Like, there is no circumstance under which I would say I will not be held hostage and leave.
All right. So she's not a great friend. But it is also abundantly clear that before she gets the idea incepted into her brain that she's going to die tomorrow,
yes.
that Jane is not a stable person.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think that's sketched out for us pretty clearly.
It is. And, you know, on now thinking about it, so Susan is also supposed to be not the best. She's not supportive of her husband.
Everybody in the movie is a little bit broken, right?
Like, yeah.
Amy is a recovering alcoholic.
Yep.
And Jane has some kind of anxiety
right.
disorder. And Susan is like... a complete narcissist.
The total
and
narcissist.
Her husband is like
a wet
blanket, codependent.
And
their two
friends, Brian
like,
and Tilly.
Brian is in denial about grief.
And Tilly just kind of sucks.
Tilly kind of sucks. So Brian and Tilly are people who Jane meets at Jason and Susan's dinner birthday party. But the whole reason I started the wind up on that is that Amy Simon said in interviews that she was that person. She can't stand small talk at parties. And she's like, why don't we go to parties and talk about death? Why don't we talk about real things? Why do I have to talk about my career and what I'm wearing and like what I just saw or what music I'm listening to?
That's fair.
Why can't we talk about real substantive things?
Yeah.
And as someone who spent, I think, probably more than I'm aware of amount of time at this birthday party that James and I both recently attended.
My name's Jamie.
Just shouting about COVID and my anxieties and about how I'm terrified that my son is going to get the fucking Delta variant because no one has to wear masks anymore because we don't have a civilization. I very much empathize with that feeling of we should be able to talk about death and the things that freak us the fuck out at parties.
I do too. And you know that I'm with you
yeah.
on that.
But some people
I try
think that's
and
a
be
bummer.
As vulnerable as I possibly can be.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's appreciated and sometimes it's not.
Some people are not down for that.
Some people are not into when I talk about my dead parents. It's kind of a bummer. But it's real.
Sometimes shit gets real.
I fully agree. We should be able to be vulnerable with yeah. one another and tell each other that we are okay or we're not.
Right. And this is an extremely vulnerable movie. It's extremely sincere. Everybody's pain is naked and just raw and totally unjudged. It's so empathetic to everybody. Like, it didn't even occur to me until you just brought it up now that Jane is a shitty friend. But the performance is great, and the writing and the direction are so good at generating empathy for that character. The big takeaway from me from that scene where she shows up at Amy's house and does not help her at all is, wow, Jane is kind of a broken person too.
Huh.
And I wasn't mad at her at all.
Now I'm curious, because the character that I empathized with, because I think this movie is an exploration of how different people might or do process the knowledge that they are going to die tomorrow.
I think that is one thing that it is explicitly about, because everybody reacts differently.
The one that I think is truest to how I would react is Amy, which I think is probably why I had the reaction to Jane that I did.
Because you wanted her to get Amy's back.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who do you... Who's relate to? Yeah. Like, were you to have this knowledge, who would you behave like?
For a movie that doesn't have a lot of plot, here's your spoiler warning for the stuff that probably happens before the end of the movie. The movie is very, I'll get back to
the
this
The movie
a
is very
bit.
Vague about what actually happens.
But yeah, who do I like empathize with most? Honestly, here's your spoilers. Susan.
It's Susan.
Because. Really? Susan, once she and her husband Jason also become convinced that they are going to die tomorrow, they then go into their teenage daughter's bedroom and wake her up and cry sobbingly and saying, "We're going to die tomorrow." And the inference is then, because we hear like the daughter crying from outside her room later on, that the daughter also becomes infected with the idea. And then Susan and Jason say, "You know what we have to do." And while the movie never tells us that they go over to Jane's house and shoot her, there is definitely some kind of intruder who comes into Jane's house right after that conversation. And then the next time we see Jane,
she's bleeding.
She is bleeding out.
And then after that, Chris Messina is asked if he's mad at Susan.
Right. Do we regret the thing that we did without telling us the thing that
exactly.
we did?
So it's a pretty strong inference that they went over and killed Jane.
Or tried to kill her and were not successful. But yeah, honestly, Jamie, if you came over to my house and you told me that you were going to die tomorrow, and then I became convinced that my wife and I were going to die tomorrow, and then we infected my kid with that idea, I would absolutely track you down and fucking kill you for doing that.
Wow. Wow.
Keep it to yourself, Jamie, all right? Don't infect me with your crazy, vague mind paranoia infectiousness.
How am I supposed to know?
All right, that's a great question. They really do know. Jane knows. Jane knows that it happens to her. She has some kind of understanding that she's passing this thing on. And then when she does pass it on, like, so Jane goes to the ER at one point later in the movie handsome doctor played by Josh Lucas, she infects him with the idea in this great little one scene performance from Josh Lucas, who I feel like I haven't seen in a while. And she infects him and she watches him and she understands what's happening to him. And the audience does with some like subtle music cues. And then he collapses into her arms and he's having like a panic attack or a heart attack. And she gets this embrace and she feels some connection to him.
Yep.
Like Jane's reaction is to, she can't handle the idea that she's going to die tomorrow.
And
so
she
starts going out and she needs somebody. And like her brother and her sister are not going to be the people who are going to embrace her and give her some kind of comfort. So she goes to the hospital to see if somebody can do something. And then she infects the doctor with it. And then she has this great little moment where she feels like, oh, okay, great. Like I'm having this embrace.
And then he has to go be with his wife.
He wants to go be with his wife. It is pretty like Jane is gearing up. Jane is DTF in this moment.
I mean, she's left literally legs display on the examining room table looking like she didn't want whatever was happening to stop.
Right. And then she goes home and she finds comfort in her work. That's one of the ways that like people handle this realization. It's something Simon's talked about. They intentionally misquote, or they intentionally paraphrase something from Camus early on in the movie. It's something that Jane says when she first shows up at the party and freaks everybody out.
Right.
That humans are the only animal that pretends to be something else. That's what Simet is talking about, the illusion that we will live on forever, that we have to ignore the idea that we're going to die. Otherwise, we'll go fucking crazy. Because if you think about it at all, like, how can you possibly move on with your day if you're just, yeah, I mean, at any moment, I could just die. But like, we have to deal with it.
This is a good moment to talk about the music choice in the movie. One of the things that I latched onto, because it's very much put front and center, is the character of Amy plays and replays, I think, four times.
I believe it's four times. She puts the record on, and then when it goes to the next track, she jumps back.
Yes. The record specifically of the Lacrimosa movement of Mozart's Requiem. And there's a telling quote that I dug up from Mozart 4 years prior to writing Requiem. And let's remember that he died in the process of writing Requiem.
Yes. Let's remember that. We all knew that ahead of time. Jamie knew that beforehand, and it wasn't something he found on Wikipedia. Please proceed.
You're a dick. You know that? You're just a douchebag.
You're pretentious. Guys, I've read 4 biographies of Mozart.
I knew that he died writing Requiem.
Oh, really?
I knew that he died writing Requiem. I knew that it was that he died when he was 35, and partly because
I'm currently
36.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And the only thing that I've done more and bigger than Mozart is live an extra year.
I don't know. I don't think Mozart ever drank 500 wines in one day, Jamie.
He might have.
He
it was
probably
the
did.
It was
yeah.
the time. And he was living in Vienna.
Yeah.
So 4 years prior to writing Requiem, he wrote to his father, and this is a hell of a quote. "As death is the true goal of our existence, I have formed, during the last few years, such close relationships with this best and truest friend of mankind that death's image is not only terrifying to me, but it is indeed very soothing and consoling." So Mozart, even prior to getting sick, because he was sick for a year before passing away, was already grappling with his own mortality in such a way that he was comfortable saying that he's like ready,
yeah.
basically. I think that plays into the music choice.
Oh, yeah,
movie.
It definitely plays like sonically with the gloom and doom and like existential dread of the characters.
Well, yeah,
but,
I mean,
yeah, that's a weighty choice to make.
Mozart's Requiem is only one Requiem, right? Like he wrote that in the tradition of the like Gregorian Requiem. And
right.
We had
his
already...
arrangement and orchestration is what makes it his.
And even the key is meant to symbolize the afterlife.
Yeah.
D minor had already been agreed upon by music people to be the key of the afterlife, which is not a thing that I knew before this. I definitely researched this before the episode.
That's fine. You did research. That's good.
I did.
That's good.
I did a little looking. Anyway, I think it's interesting that Mozart was thinking about death that early in this specific way, and then that also he was commissioned to write this Requiem and died in the process, and specifically died before finishing the most famous movement, which is the Lacrimosa movement that we hear over and over in
repeatedly.
This. He had only gotten through 8 bars of Lacrimosa before it had to be taken over by one of his students.
Oh, wow.
While it, on surface, I think, can feel maybe like the easy choice to put Requiem in this movie, because it is it's about death.
Right.
Explicitly. It's also, it goes deeper than that.
Yeah, it's not a casual choice. And the thing about the use of Requiem is that it may be an easy, like the connections are already there to the subject matter. But what's not easy is that the audience hears it front to back, that entire movement, 2 times, and then she puts it on a 3rd time, and we kind of like, you know, montage through that next bit.
Yep.
Which is an aggressive sonic choice for an audience.
It is, despite the fact that that piece of music is heart-stoppingly beautiful.
It's gorgeous, but like, yeah, if you play a song or a piece of music twice in a row, like you are already testing your audience's patience. It's not conventional.
True.
Which is something the totally unconventional stylings in this movie is what just sucks me in like about it so much, is that she doesn't ever do anything that's easy or expected. So whenever someone, when it really sets in, there's like some deep bassy, like horror movie score. Simons uses a lot of horror movie tropes in something that's not really a horror movie, right? Like the threat is entirely internal. There's no externalization to it, but it gives you a sense of dread. And then there's also these pulsing, strobing, flashing red and blue and occasionally green lights that really key us into like, all right, great. So somebody is really staring down this rabbit hole and they're just like Amy and Jane now.
What are your thoughts on that, on its effectiveness, on what it evoked from you?
It's extremely effective, right? This movie is so purely cinematic in that we were talking earlier off mic that it, to compare it to something else we've talked to, it's very much the anti-Tenet. The dialogue is important to character and theme, but not for plot. Narrative is entirely conveyed through visuals and audio.
Mm-hmm.
So like, of course it's effective because you completely understand it. You see it one time and then you see it again and you're like, great, this is a pattern. And whenever I hear this and see this flashing, I understand. And nobody needs to explain it, because how could you possibly fucking explain it? Like,
right.
Like dialogue would not be good enough. It's extremely effective. It's evocative. It's unsettling as shit. The use of the strobing lights, like the lights are positioned around their faces in different ways so that as the lights strobe, their faces change shape. Like it casts shadows in different ways. It's super upsetting.
In particular on Amy.
Oh, yeah.
The first time that
big close-up that she gets.
Yeah. The lights change the way her makeup appears.
Yep.
Under the green light, it doesn't look like she's wearing much lipstick at all.
Yeah.
And then under the red or blue, I can't remember. It becomes like very pronounced, almost like horrifying, poorly drawn on lipstick. It completely changes the expression on her face almost. Yeah.
In terms of the things that the average moviegoer might encounter, right? Like, this is easily the most difficult movie to watch and unpack because it leans purely on what cinema can do to, like, give you the journey, right? Like, it's all about empathy and about visuals and about sound to convey what's happening and less about plot and dialogue and right. action. The whole thing with who shoots Jane, like, what happens to Jane? We infer that Jason and Susan go to her house to kill her. But they never state it. We sense, like Jane does, that there's someone's entered her home to do her harm. The music tells us, like a slasher, like fucking yeah. Michael Myers is coming down the stairs in a Shatner mask. But we don't see the actor. We don't see the act. We don't see the act of violence. We just see the aftermath in the room later where there's like blood all over her equipment. And then we catch up with her later on at Michelle Rodriguez's house and she's bleeding out, but she's totally emotionally unfazed by it. She's not mad. She's because she already thought she was going to die. So being shot kind of confirms that for her. She's not mad at her brother. We catch up with Jason and Susan later on, and they dance around talking about the thing that they did, but they don't say what they did. And then they move on, and they're not even concerned with it because they're focused on their own kid and their own self-absorption. We don't see the act of violence, I think, because it didn't happen to any of the characters. Like, they're all so obsessed with their own impending death that they think is coming that the act of violence isn't important. So I think, like, thematically it's significant that we don't see it, but I also think it's part of Simitz's directorial style that, like, man, it's a fucking movie. We've been making these things for 120 years. Is there anything less interesting on screen than a gunshot?
Yeah.
Like, it's just not compelling.
It's not something you need to see. And all you need to see, really, is Susan asks Jason, are you mad at me? And he says, what do you think? So yes, I'm mad at you, but it also doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
That which is, oh my God, it's a lot to digest in 6 words of dialogue.
Yeah, she...
Are you mad at me? Does it matter?
Right.
7 words of dialogue. Yeah.
She leaves out the stuff that is boring and uninteresting and like concrete and tangible. And when you get dialogue, it's weighty, right? It reveals a lot of character and a lot about relationships, and it's never about plot, and we just don't show that stuff. She never does the expected thing in terms of camera placement and conveying information to the audience. She would rather be elliptical and have an idea trail off or have you lean in and try to infer something than just outright state it.
Yeah.
And then not knowing just makes you sit forward a little bit and listen very carefully to everything that they're saying.
Yeah.
She really gets you involved and gets you to emotionally intuit it. She's not a didactic filmmaker. She doesn't tell you how to feel and how to interpret things. She just lays it out there in not conventional ways, but in very intuitive ways that if you're attentive and empathetic audience, you shouldn't have any difficulty following what's happening in this movie unless you want like the Chris Nolan version where you understand explicitly every single point of the plot and why he went here and what the justification was for it. Like, she doesn't roll that way. Simitz told Matt Seitz in that Vulture piece again that exposition becomes catnip for the audience. But when the filmmaker or performer delivers information through actions and expressions, the audience has to pay attention because we're not going to feed it all to you verbally. You just have to go with us. Like, you get to the end of this movie, yeah. and for all the other things that you're experiencing with it, you feel fucking smart. Like, isn't it nice to watch a movie where you can, like, you are an actively engaged participant?
It's very nice. Not only did I felt like I got it the first time, but I also felt like there was more and that I wanted to go back and sort of examine everything. I wanted to examine my first takes and I got them largely confirmed. I really enjoy the movie.
Oh, I don't know that I enjoy it. I think it's great and I really like it and I admire it in some of the reviews
that I read.
I wouldn't
watch it for pleasure. Like, it's not a thing that I would, you know, sit down with a group of friends and say, hey, you guys are going to love this.
Yeah, it's not a happy, fun time hanging out with people kind of movie.
No.
And yet I don't find the movie like super depressing. Like, despite the subject matter, it doesn't fucking bum me out.
No. No, it makes me think. It makes me think a lot. It doesn't make me like scared about impending death or anything.
Right. We were already there.
Yes, we were. It's true. We were already there. But it makes me think about, like, how I would react to it. A weird experience that I had during this movie, and we may or may not cut this part because it may or may not be a huge bummer. The character of Brian. We don't get a lot from him, but the one thing that we do in a huge way get from him, I do firmly empathize with, which is pulling the plug on a parent. It was weird for me to watch that. It was kind of like an out-of-body situation. You were there with me when this happened to me specifically. Yeah. I told the doctors to pull the plug on my own mother. It's a gut-wrenching, impossible situation that no one could possibly be prepared for ever. He does it completely dispassionately, and because he's convinced that he's going to die, obviously. Right. Like, this is the first thing that he has to do.
Well, it gives him clarity. Like, Jane goes into, like, a free fall and needs somebody to catch her and support her, right? And Amy is having, like, a movie-length panic attack about thinking that she's going to die.
Right.
And Susan and Jason can only think about their family and about, like, vengeance on the person who did it to them.
Right.
And Brian gets this, like, beautiful crystalline clarity in that. This is a thing I have to go do, and I should have done it forever ago. And then he and Tilly have a very frank, candid conversation about this relationship doesn't work, and we probably should have broken it off. And I would have left you before, except I was waiting for 3 months after your dad died. Like,
yep.
They have this incredible clarity that comes from it, similar to what Emrod has when we go to her house at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, for the two of them, it's about action. For Tilly, it's, I'm with this person, and I shouldn't be with this person anymore.
Right. But then she's going to be with him when he has to do the big thing.
And Brian and Tilly are tertiary characters.
Right.
And there's so much to talk about with how they react individually, not even just together.
It's a real good movie.
It's a good movie.
There's a lot to chew on. It's 85 minutes long. It has immaculate and thoughtful and provocative craft. The performances are all great. There is a ton to chew on. And it, unfortunately, and this is something Simon's talked about in interviews, like the movie very quickly got labeled 2020 the movie. Which, of course,
no.
It was made in 2019, but, like, it came out, had its premiere in April when we were all stuck in our houses, and it's about people who, like, can't get out of their own heads because they're convinced that there's something out there that's going to make them die right away. Like, I think it's a very 2020 movie accidentally. It resonates with a lot of themes that many of us were dealing with last year about isolation and being faced with our own mortality in ways that we hadn't ever done before.
That's interesting. I don't know that I guess it just, it didesn't read to me like such a pandemic movie.
Well, no, but it's not a pandemic movie.
No.
Like, it just came along at the right time. It came along at exactly the right and wrong time for a lot of people. It was a very difficult watch a year ago. It's a slightly less difficult watch.
It's a pretty difficult watch now. I don't feel like I would have had an easier time watching this movie in 2019 than I did in 2021. Maybe I would have. I don't know. Feels like a good time to transition into the pairing.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, how it pairs. I didn't have any magic synesthetic moment here. I may more have if we had had the prestige worldwide. But it, like I said, the wine was comfortable and it grounded me. And when I felt uncertain with the movie, uncertain with literally what is happening or uncertain in terms of like my own sense of like comfort or stability, the wine was right there and it was red. It was a familiar red, and if you put something like weird and wild and funky and pet natty with this movie, like it would not have had any kind of grounding stability for me.
No, and I think it would have been discordant. It would have been distracting. I have a similar feeling. You know, if it had been the VAA Prestige, I think we would have had some real synesthesia, but like in a bad way. I think that the
they would
extreme
have fed off each other.
Tannin and full body and extraction of that wine would have increased the feeling of dread that this movie gives you.
Yeah, all the scary horror music and flashing lights, that's tannic. That shit is tannic and astringent and scrapey and unpleasant and maybe masks the other things that are more enjoyable.
Yeah.
I think that's not a terribly protracted analog there. I think that makes sense.
I agree with that. And so this wine being a little bit softer, being a little bit more familiar, I think I meant off mic earlier, I said that this wine was comforting. And I think it is.
Because it tastes like every red wine I've ever had.
Sure, every red wine you've ever had.
To my undiscerning palate. I mean, this tastes like every good red wine I've ever had. It doesn't taste like Rex Goliath.
Yeah, it's comfortable. It's medium plus body. It's not like light or full. It's medium plus tannin. It's not huge or like diminished. It's got fruit and earth. It's got a little bit of oak. It's very balanced. It feels familiar. Like you said, it feels like a good red wine. This is a good red wine.
It's a good red wine.
And in that way, it serves as a good walking stick to get you through this difficult movie. Anytime this movie throws you off balance, which it does every 5 minutes, because it forces you to confront something probably horrible within yourself.
And it does it in a way where it doesn't hold your hand and explain to you what's happening and right. how you should feel about it. It makes you figure out how to feel and what just happened.
A sip of this wine steadies you. I have a couple of thoughts on things that might work better or equally as good in the comfort way, and also things that may give some amount of synesthesia to the challenging parts of this movie. On the comfort side, if anyone out there has ever had Duckhorn Merlot, Duckhorn is a landmark property in Napa. Their Merlot is the benchmark for Merlot, or okay. has been for the last like half century. That wine is similarly kind of soft and comforting, and I think would be a really, really great sort of grounding for this movie. And in a similar way, Calera Pinot Noir, ironically, they're both owned by the same company now. Calera out of the Central Coast of California gives you sort of a sense of stability. And then the last thing that I put there was also a whiskey and Coke would be like sort of a comforting kind of drink.
Really?
To have with this like really jarring existential movie.
Sweet and bubbly. Yeah, I can't. You've tried it before. I'm still not like at an intuitive place where I can think about contrapuntal pairings. You know, like I can only think about something that reflects the same thing.
Right.
I can't go in the opposite directions. Maybe I'll try and do that at some point coming up. But that doesn't make any sense to me.
Just think of the most challenging part of this movie for you. What was the part that like really kind of set your teeth on edge?
It's the birthday party. It's Jane coming into the birthday party just because of the social anxiety.
Right.
Because you're uncomfortable for Jane. You like she's in her pajamas. She's not stable. She's sounding unbalanced. And everyone is looking at her like she's wild and she's clearly frightened. And I feel bad for her. I feel bad for everybody at the party.
Yeah. Even Susan, who is behaving like a pain in the ass.
Like it's her party. She.
Okay. So now imagine watching that scene.
Right.
And you've got like a cold with ice whiskey and Coke.
Yeah.
And it's bubbly and it's sweet, like that Coca-Cola nostalgia to it that just makes you feel sort of grounded and at ease. That's what I'm going for. And I think that's what this wine does. And I think that's what Duckhorn and Calera would do.
Interesting. I think it's a fine pairing. I think they worked well enough together.
I think ultimately this is the best way to go.
Yeah.
I think amplifying the challenging parts would just, at least for me, and maybe this is just like post-pandemic Jamie being sensitive to stress, would raise my blood pressure to a point that I would want to turn the movie off.
Yeah. I mean, it's not easy.
No.
I think this worked out well. I hope people dug the movie. And if you have questions about it, like I'm certainly not an expert, but like I've spent some time thinking about it. And if people want to like unpack it, as Jamie will say, slide into these DMs and hit us up. I would love to talk with people about it because I think it's weird. And I think it pushes a lot of people out of their comfort zones in a way that doesn't feel safe.
Yeah.
Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, and If Beale Street Could Talk, who went to like college at Florida State with Amy Simon, said that with an Amy Simon's movie, you never know what's going to happen next, and you never know when it's going to end, which is another way of saying, like, you are very uncertain the entire time.
Yeah.
And that can feel unsafe if you're not used to watching this kind of movie. So, yeah, if you felt unsafe watching it, hit me up. I would love to talk about it.
And similarly, I hope you enjoyed this wine. I think just by itself, it's a delicious wine.
It's like red.
Like I said earlier, it's not the kind of thing that I drink that often because I'm a seeker of the, like, light-bodied, red fruit driven high acid red wine, but I'm always happy to find a wine like this in my glass because it's comforting. I think that this is the kind of wine that you could keep a case of in your house and just like if you feel like a bottle of wine on literally whatever night, pull this out.
Yeah, this feels like a good house red for me.
Yeah.
Something that's always reliable and it'll go with like a lot of food too.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think specifically this wine, this is like burger wine, but even more specifically, this is like meatball sub wine.
Well, Jamie, you should have stopped at burger wine because when we stop recording, we're having burgers for dinner, baby.
Are we really?
Them burgers are done.
I love them burgers.
They're not done. We have to wrap it up because I have to go cook them before the thunderstorm rolls in.
I'm excited for some burgers.
All right, James, let's start winding it down.
Yeah.
So friends, listeners, fans, audience, humans, we're just wrapping up this little unofficial mini-series on some of my favorite overlooked 2020 movies.
So I decided that we should do a little six-episode mini-series on the wines of America. Admittedly, most of them are going to be from California. I'm sorry to the states that I've left out, but largely the story of American wine begins and ends in California. There's plenty in between. We touch on Oregon and we touch on New York. We'll do more episodes in this podcast.
That's perfectly fine. I mean, America is the greatest country in the world, Jamie. We have to have the greatest wine. And obviously, we're going to do plenty more American wines and movies on this show.
Fully agreed on some of those points.
Yeah.
I didn't want to start at the very beginning because the very beginning is like pre-Prohibition. And I didn't want to start at right after Prohibition because a lot of those wines are the wines that I don't like to drink. The really like obnoxious, huge Cabernet Sauvignons of the world. The reaction to those is where I've started in our sort of tale of America. And what better a winemaker to start that off with than Randall Graham of Bonnie Doon? So we're going to start next week with the 2020 Bonnie Doon Le Cigar Blanc Grenache Blanc blend from Arroyo Seco, which is in Monterey.
Where can people get that wine?
People can get that wine from Astor Wine and Spirits.
Word.
They are based in Manhattan and ship nationwide.
Excellent. And what is the price point on that there bottle?
It's $24-ish.
That's not bad.
Everything that I've gotten is under $30 a bottle.
Excellent. And Jamie, what are the words? What are the descriptive words you have for this here wine?
All right. So I got a little extemporaneous for the words that I use to describe all of the wines for this season because I'm pretty passionate about these wines. And also, I wanted to see where Scott would go. So the words that I use to describe Bonnie Doon Le Cigar Blanc are alien, quaffable, tropical, and sustaining vibrato.
Indeed. Speaking of words, Jamie does not know what extemporaneous means, but if he does, then this makes sense that he was just picking all of these words off the cuff, because that is a weird selection of adjectives for me to go with. I am, the shoe is on the other foot for the next six episodes, because I'm doing all of the pairings here, but based on alien, quaffable, tropical, and sustaining vibrato, I picked a terrific, weird, long movie that I'm a big fan of and is a little controversial and a little underloved and very underseen. David Robert Mitchell's sophomore feature, Under the Silver Lake. Mitchell was the director of the indie breakout It Follows. This movie stars Andrew Garfield as a lazabout millennial living in the L.A. Silver Lake neighborhood who is obsessed with conspiracy theories, and he is tracking down a girl that he met in his apartment complex who goes missing, and only the weird clues on cereal boxes and on records will lead him to find her. It is very strange. Check it out. Under the Silver Lake, distributed by A24. It's currently available to stream on Hoopla and Canopy, which are two free streaming services that all you need is a membership with a participating library, and you can sign up very easily for either of those. You can also stream it on Showtime or via the Showtime trial on Amazon or Hulu, or you can just plunk down your $3.99 and rent it anywhere. I think it's terrific. It's a handful. And I'm very curious to see what Jamie thinks of it, because he might hate it. It's pretty wild.
I'm excited.
Yeah. So that is next time on. Watch Under the Silver Lake and drink the 2020 Bonnie Doon Le Cigar Blanc.
All right. And we've got a new review.
We have a new review from not friend of the show.
We don't recognize this username, nor do we recognize the syntax in this review, so we're guessing that this is like an actual organic review. Thank you.
Let's say new friend of the show. I don't mean to say that they're not our friend, but this is our first organic review generated by someone who was not already invested in our well-being and success.
Correct.
So this is from Apple Podcast user Biff4321. Thank you, Biff4321. And the review is titled Chemistry. And Biff says, these two cats have very good chemistry. You might have to wait for the movie that speaks to you, but either way, very entertaining. Thank you very much, Biff. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Biff.
Everybody out there listening, you should know that the chemistry is entirely a front and that Jamie and I are actually world-class actors and improvisers and that we otherwise never speak nor look to each other when we're not doing the show.
Yeah, we certainly haven't been friends for 24 years.
Shut up.
24 agonizing, horrible years.
If you are listening and enjoying the show, and if you're hearing this, you're doing at least one of those things, please give us a review on the old Apple Podcasts. Reviews and ratings on Apple Podcasts help other people find the show and help us find new audiences and are disproportionately way more important to a podcast success than ratings and subscribes anywhere else. But also continue listening and rating and following us on any other platform that you're at. And anytime you write a review, we will read it on the air.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you all.
As Scotty said, remember to rate, review, and follow.
Follow.
Follow us also on all of the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. If you have any questions, concerns, comments, whatever, feel free to email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. And remember, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you, we promise.
But like good movies. Watch the good ones.
Also good wine.
Right. But good movies are more important. Okay, good night, everyone. Let's go have some burgers.
Burgers!
Thank you.